obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
I'd like to welcome everybody to the Hospitals and Institutions meeting of the 64th Annual Southern California Convention. My name is Joe Waddle. I'm an alcoholic.
Joe!
Hey, before we start, a couple little housekeeping items. In consideration of our speakers, we request that each person please turn off your cell phones. Tanya. And put them away. And please, no texting. It's pretty disruptive. No smoking in the facility. This includes vaping. We ask that you go outside in the designated smoking areas. And please keep in mind we're guests here at the convention center in the hotel, and we represent our fellowship in the spirit of attraction. With that being said, will you please join with me in the serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And this morning I have asked Marty to read chapter 3 out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous.
All right, Marty.
My name is Marty and I am an alcoholic.
Marty.
There. Most of us have been, chapter 3, more about alcoholism. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is a great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. We are like men who have lost their legs. They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. We have tried every imaginable remedy. In some instances, there have been brief recovery, followed always by a still worse relapse. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree there is no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. Science may one day accomplish this, but it hasn't done so yet. Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe they are in that class. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exceptions to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. If anyone who is showing inability to control his drinking can do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. Here are some of the methods we have tried: drinking beer only, limiting the number of drinks, never drinking alone, never drinking in the morning, drinking only at home, never having it in the house, never drinking during business hours, drinking only at parties, switching from scotch to brandy, drinking only natural wines, agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job, taking a trip, not taking a trip, swearing off forever with and without a solemn oath, taking more physical exercise, reading inspirational books, going to health farms and sanitariums, accepting voluntary commitment to asylums. We can increase the list ad infinitum.
Thank you, Marty. This morning we asked someone to read chapter 5 for us. Debbie, is that you?
No.
Oh, Nick, sorry.
Nick.
Hi guys, I'm Nick and I'm an alcoholic. Chapter 5, how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for us, but there is one who has all power, and that one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order, I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventure before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought.
Thank you, Nick. And this morning I have asked Debbie to come up and read the 12 traditions for us.
Hi, I'm Debbie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Debbie.
To 12 traditions. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Debbie, thank you. Gives me great pleasure to introduce our 10-minute speaker, Bob B. from Long Beach.
Yeah, I was going to call it Long Beach.
Hi, I'm Bob, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Bob.
Grateful to know I'm an alcoholic today. I wasn't an alcoholic when I got here, but I am now, and I'll be forever grateful to know that because I never knew what the problem was. I'd like to thank Revo for carousing me into this privilege about 20 minutes ago. You will find out I am not a speaker. But what I am is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and so I do have something to share. Joe was wondering where I'm from because my wife and I just bought a house in Arizona. And my wife is still here, and I'm in Arizona, so I guess I'm still half a Californian right now. So, and that's a good deal. And it's all gifts from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, how we were able to do that. I'll start off real quick that I believe I was an alcoholic from the day I came out of my mother. My dad was a very good alcoholic right up until the day he died from alcoholism. And, it didn't apply to me. I had my first drink at a very young age. Probably 6 or 7, because my dad liked to throw kegger parties during the summertime out back and have all the neighbors over. And it was cute to see little Bobby serving everybody beers, you know, and of course you got to sip them on the way back. Well, if you spend an afternoon sipping beers, you're pretty much going to get drunk by the time. And, I experienced that relief. Even at that young age, I was the inside and the outside just weren't even close. There was a lot of turmoil, a lot of insecurities, a lot of fears, a lot of all the things we talk about here were all there. And that alcohol took that away. So I chased that for a lot of years. And It was hard for me to think that alcohol was a problem because alcohol's always been my answer to everything. And then I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and you took that away from me. And I'll be grateful forever for that because I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous was designed to take the place of the drink. What the drink did to me and for me, Alcoholics Anonymous does that today. I landed in a 12-step house, which was based off the Oxford groups, and it was about sit down, shut up and listen, go get a job, clean ashtrays, set up chairs, make coffee, and sit there and listen and practice that. I got a little bit of sobriety going on in 1996. And so I was ready to go. I was ready to go back out on my own and you know, I had a job and I had some money and life was good. And the next thing I know, I'm loaded and wondering what the hell happened. Well, what had happened is that I had no program. You know, the program is the steps. So if you're not doing the steps, you're not doing the program. That's how I see it. And so when I got back in 2000, I kept doing the same thing, you know, and I was sober a couple of years, and I just had a thought one night. I says, you know, you're not doing anything different than what you were doing. And fortunately, that was a night of a board meeting, and the chairman of the board was someone I knew, and I went down and asked him to be my sponsor, and he's still my sponsor today, which is a real big reason why I'm standing up here today. And then we started doing things. You know, for me, this is a program. It's not an academic. We're not getting tested on our what we do around here. You know, it's about experiences. You know, I do this, and then I get to experience this. And my experience is that anything I've gotten from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is more than I could ever came up with. Sometimes I wonder, you know, how has all this happened? I'm a drunk off the streets. You know, that's what I ended up being. You know, I abandoned a daughter when she was 3 years old, her and her mother, you know. That's the guy that stood here when I got here. And the thing was, nobody here knew that, but I knew it. You know, and the problem was, I suffer from a disease of perception. And the funny thing is that, you know, even an ex-wife that I did not treat very well, I didn't treat her as bad as she thought I did. But I thought I was treating her very bad, you know. And it's amazing to me that the way I see things just isn't right. You know, I just don't see things right. I just don't think right. Because I am a thinker. You know, I love to think. Didn't do me any good, but I love to think. And I'm not so much a thinker today. You know, I went through I got back into that 12-step house. And, you know, the funny thing, I mean, I made a lot of mistakes while I was drinking. And, but I made a whole lot of mistakes when I was sober. You know, because I thought this was all about drinking. And once I'm done drinking, then, you know, hell, life is good, right? I don't drink. And the truth of the matter is I've made a lot of mistakes while I'm sober. And the good news is I have people who love me when I don't love myself. And they're willing to guide me in the right direction. And it's up to me to do that. You know, I tell people my feet have gotten real smart. You know, my feet are much smarter than my brain. My feet will do things, and it's like I do them because that's what I do. You know, that's what I do. And so hopefully we get some smart feet around here and we know what to do, you know. And I'm standing up here speaking because someone asked me to do this, you know, because I don't like doing this. So it's probably the best thing for me because I don't know what's good for me anyway. Not even today. You know, my sobriety date is October 23rd, 2000, and my sponsor is Scott Bond. And my home group is still the Inner City Group until I get a new one in Arizona. And these are the reasons why I'm sober today. As far as I know, that's because that's all I know, you know, and that's because that's what you told me what I needed to do, not because that's what I came up with, because I have much better plan for Bob, and we all know Bob's plans don't work out very well. How are we doing on time here, buddy? 5 minutes. Okay.
We cut that in half.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah, you know, the disease of perception thing, I mean, it was always, Sometimes I get so amazed how I can look at a certain situation and I have this big, grandized view of it, and everybody else around me, they didn't even see it. It didn't even exist. And that was my life. You know, I turned everything into a big production. You know, and really it wasn't even on the TV channel. It wasn't even there. And I probably should have got here around 1967, 68. When I was still in high school, we had a speaker last night, and God, I love her to death. She got sober when she was 14 years old. Wow. Amazing. And I could have easily been here when I was 14 years old. But, you know, I had to wait until I was 43. I had to continue to take hostages along the way and get enablers along the way to allow me to do what I did. And, you know, I always worked. I always went to work. I was always to work on time. You know, I was that actor. I was that guy painting a picture. You know, but it wasn't, what you saw on the outside wasn't the same on the inside. And this thing has changed my insides. One of the greatest things that's happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I've learned how to cry. And you can ask my wife. I don't cry over sadness. I cry over happy things. My heart feels joy, and I have tears. And you know, I'm just a big softy now, you know. That guy I was running from, you know. I remember being a kid, and that would happen. Something would happen to somebody, and I would tear up because I felt, you know what I mean? And now I embrace that. I'm so grateful for things like that. So many things happen in this program, and you don't even know they're happening. And then you come to see that you're like, wow. I have a lot of, I call them aha moments. It's like, aha, so that's what those guys meant. Aha, so that's what she meant or he meant. And that's why we don't leave before the miracle. You know, I don't know what your miracle is. My miracle is that I woke up sober this morning and with a couple of guys at 5. And by about 5:10, we were laughing our asses off and enjoying each other's companies. You know, that's just not normal for me. I don't do things like that. Not at all. We forgot to put the filter in the coffee maker this morning, so it went all over the counter.
Love that.
And you know what? Give me an opportunity to go off, and that would have been it. You know, I'm going to tell you how stupid you are, and if I had done it, it would have been fine. I don't know who did it, but, you know. And, you know, it was something we laughed about, and we cleaned it up and made another pot of coffee. That's what you do, you know. You don't. This self-centered anger stuff is just, God, it's controlled me for my life, and it's done nothing but gave me an opportunity to feed my ego. You know, my grand sponsor came back from Hawaii a few years ago. He says, "I never thought I'd hear anything new in AA." He says, "But I heard the Spanish guy just stood up. And he says, my ego is not my amigo," and he sat right back down.
Love that.
And Marv's got about 44 years now. He says, there's no way I was going to hear anything new. And then he heard that. So, you know, Marv's another reason. And Marv's sponsor is another reason. You know, this stuff's whatever it is. And I'm not saying I know what it is, but it gets handed down. And I'm grateful to have that lineage that goes back years and years and years. Yes, sir. Anyway, we have a real good speaker today, and I'm sure he's going to change up his story on you. So anyway, thank you for letting me share.
Thank you very much, Bob.
And that was great. I was the guy on the coffee maker, just so everybody's clear on that, okay? You got to be smarter than the coffee maker, and I wasn't, obviously. Hey, it gives me great pleasure to be able to introduce this next gentleman who we've had the privilege of watching. We're all Harbor Area H&I folks, and Shane joined us with some real motivation. He was eager, but he had that deer in the headlights look, which we all loved. And, you know, it's been a pleasure really watching him grow. But more importantly, I watched him in our committee meetings we do every month. And he's quick to grab chairs. He's quick to help out. He's quick to talk to new people. And I think that's what this thing is about. So I'd like to welcome our speaker, Shane, please.
Whew. Shane, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Shane.
Like I know almost everybody in the room, which is crazy. You come to a convention to talk 100 miles away, and you know everybody there. You know why? Because this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and like we surround each other with love or whatever. We show up for each other, and that's nice. My mother is here, Suzanne. It's this woman right here. Not the one on the left, the one on the right. And another friend came to join me, someone that's known me for a very long time. This is a girlfriend of mine, Nikki, who she's sober a long time. She's sober 29 and a half years. And yeah, so I met her in Young People's AA a long, long time ago, and I hadn't seen her in 22 years. And she flew in to see me, to hear me speak for you people. For all 12 of you. This is perfect, man. My morning meeting, there's like 250 people every, you know, and I talk there all the time. Not all the time, but I talk a lot there. So this is more comfortable for me, man. This is perfect. This is my wheelhouse right here. Talking to a room full of drunks, because this is the way that I got sober, and this is how we did it. And it's absolutely, everything's as it should be, and it's perfect. And they've been very, I want to thank Revo for asking me to come share with you guys. And they've been very accommodating. The hotel room's really nice. The place is beautiful. God, isn't this gorgeous? I've never been to the Westin and Rancho Mirage before. And if you know where I came from, you would say that I'm doing okay with the Westin and Rancho Mirage. And, you know, I'm watching the ducks swim in the little pond this morning. And, yeah. So I have. There's a couple of stories. I'm going to open with one story. And this first story is about, it's not a joke, it's about a priest, a minister, and a rabbi, and they're at this multicultural seminar in the woods in Colorado, and they're having a debate all night long, who's the best at, you know, recruiting new members for their faith. And so they come to an agreement that in the morning, each is going to go out and they're going to seek a bear, and whoever can convert their bear is the best. That's the challenge. The challenge is to convert a bear to your faith. So they decide to leave the cabin at 8 o'clock, and they're going to meet back at noon. They've got 4 hours. So at noon, the minister's back and the Catholic priest is back, but no sight of the rabbi. So they start sharing, and the minister says, "Well, I found my bear down by the creek." He said, "We baptized him in the creek right there and then. He's coming to Bible study next week, right?" So he converted his bear, and the Catholic priest says, "Well, I found my bear. You know, I was traveling up the side of a mountain. I found my bear on a trail, and taught him the catechism. He's going to have his first communion next Wednesday." So he converted his bear. And right when he gets done talking, the rabbi comes in, and the rabbi is just frantic. And he's scratched up really bad. He's in really bad shape. And he tells him, "I don't think I should have started with the circumcision." So, it's just a stupid old joke. Who tells a joke like that from the podium in Alcoholics Anonymous? My sobriety date is June 21st of 2000, class of 2000, with my friend Bob here. And Yeah, so it's been quite a journey. It's only been 15 and a half years, which is, you know, to some people that's a lot of time, and to some people it's not so much. Hi, Tanya. Some of my favorite people are in this room right now. So what happened for me was, tell a little bit about what it was like growing up. And I can't lie because my mother is here. It's the first time she's come to hear me talk since I've been out. I send her the tape. I spoke at Paramount, and it was a pretty good talk that I gave, I think, at Paramount. And my cousin like put it into a sound file so I can send it to my family members. I have people that, you know, from all over. I could just text them the talk, right? Because people are like, oh, we want to hear you come talk, but they never get in a car to drive where I'm talking. So how can you hear me talk if you never get in a car, right? And so I just send them the sound bite or whatever. But so she's heard that, but she's never actually been to a meeting with me to hear me speak. She tried to make it to the cook-off last year and got lost en route, as she tends to do. And so she showed up about 11 o'clock. My talk was over at 10. It was perfect. It was good, though. I gave her a bunch of crap about that for a long time. And so growing up, I grew up in the 70s. I'm dating myself a little bit, but I was born in 1966, and I'm going to tell you what grade school was like for me. Grade school was, I had an older brother who was, I saw him as an overachiever, but he wasn't. He was like the hero, and I was kind of like the favorite kid type thing. I was my mother's favorite, she'll tell you. And I've been this attention-seeking way before I ever took a drink. I always wanted to be the center of attention, and if it was, you know, good attention, and I was the gold star kid. Like, I wanted more gold stars than anybody else. But I'm going to tell you what happened for me in second grade was I got elected class president because I had, like, the most gold stars, and I really wasn't a goof off yet, but it was second grade, and I was elected class president, which is a huge honor for a seven-year-old. And in a week, I was impeached by my class as class president. It was when the Nixon era thing was going on, right? And they had a vote, and they voted me out of office, man, in second grade. Because I did something, man. I can't remember what I did, but I was actually impeached as class president in second grade. So, you know, it was attention either way, right? Now I'm getting attention for the bad behavior. Good behavior, bad behavior, I'm getting attention. I didn't really care. And, you know, I've always had this mouth. I tend to, you know, say whatever is on my mind. It just kind of comes out, and that started at an early age, and it caused a lot of you know, other kids. I would just offend other children and adults and stuff, and I just didn't really care. You know, I didn't even realize that I was doing it, I guess. And
to obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
I think I took my first drink. We grew up kind of crazy, man. And I know I only have a half hour. I'll get through this. My parents decided to move to Oregon when I was 8 years old. So they took us from, I grew up in Los Feliz area of Los Angeles. And, you know, till I was eight, it was Atwater Avenue. There was a lot of gang stuff going on and like Pachuco gang, you know, like old school gang, like the real gangs before the Crips and the Bloods and all that. Like, it was a predominantly Hispanic neighborhood that I grew up in. And, they decide to move us from there to, we don't know where we're going really. My stepfather built, really bad alcoholic, he built a house on the back of an international truck, like the shingled roofed house on the back of a truck. It was the 70s. And we proceeded to drive up the coast of California toward Oregon, I guess. We were headed for Oregon because they wanted to get away from the city life. Well, I had just come from, we were living, it was Wilshire District, kind of lower Beverly Hills. I went to 3rd Street School. We lived in the 90210. All my friends are like super rich kids. It was just kind of a weird place for us to be for a while. And so we had moved from Los Feliz over to Beverly, and that was a whole different trip. And So we hit the road in this van, and we start. But my parents are kind of hippie-ish, you know. My stepfather is a Green Beret, right? He was a Green Beret. Was he a Green Beret? Yeah. Something like that. Merchant Marine, something like that. He was infantry, and he had all I know is he had a uniform and a bunch of medals, and he was an expert marksman, and he was all business. This guy, to me, he was all business, and he was also very alcoholic and very abusive, and he wasn't necessarily abusive with us kids, but he was very abusive with my mother. And so I'm 8 years old, and we're on the road, and we're headed for Oregon in this house built on the back of a truck. And we stopped at every festival, you know, every national park. That we broke down one time at the Feather River in Quincy. We broke down in the international. The motor blew up, so we spent a month in a park. We're bathing in the Feather River. So I go from this inner city kid to living in the wilderness, basically, in a state park, you know, and it's just a huge culture shock. But when you're a kid, you kind of adapt, you know, you get through whatever you get through. But I saw firsthand experience with alcoholism. I didn't realize what I was seeing. What I saw was, you know, abuse, which there was never anything like that before in our lives. My mother, she was a single mother, and she raised us, you know, absolutely the best she could, good provider, great mother. And but at 8, she met this guy, and you know, things kind of got a little wacky. So we get to Oregon, and I'm the new kid. And in between 8 years old and 12 years old, I went to 9 different schools. And so, I mean, I had an older brother, but he really didn't care for me too much. We had a serious sibling rivalry. I mean, it was kind of like an undercurrent sibling rivalry. Like, we're brothers, but he didn't, like, look out for me at school or beat up. He wasn't my protector. It was none of that. You get in trouble, you're on your own type trip, right? So, and I have this mouth. I have this problem, man. And I like to say stuff to people, and I'm the new kid. So I get beat up a lot at school. Not really beat up, but like, you know, what fourth and fifth graders do to each other at school. You're getting tripped at recess time, that kind of stuff. But I never really felt like I fit in. And then what happened was I learned how to become a chameleon. Like, I could fit in with whoever, wherever, however. And, you know, we adapt when we're young. So that was my experience growing up. I went to a bunch of different schools, and we landed in Huntington Beach, and that's where my drinking career began. Like, I realized that the effects produced by alcohol and drugs are a huge part of my story. But I realized that these, like, I really didn't care about my past or the way that I grew up, or anything. And it wasn't a bad childhood. I had a good childhood. I'm not going to complain about that. But I didn't realize that something was missing, man. Like, I took the first drinker, I first hit a weed, something like that. It was probably, I was 12, so it was 78. And, like, I was home. I absolutely loved the effects produced by drugs and alcohol. I always drank and used for effect. It was never any other reason. Like, and here's what happened for me. Like, I always want to be high now. You introduce me to something that makes me feel good, it makes me not feel insecure, that makes me easy with my friends. You introduce me to something like that and give me that ease and comfort that we get from taking a drink or taking a drug, I want it all the time. I'm a full-time kind of guy. Like, I want round the clock. Like, I would like to wake up at 3 a.m., use the restroom, and take a bong hit, you know, like, and then go back to sleep. Like, I always want to be under the influence. Even in my sleep, I want to be under the influence. So I was actually pretty, I was fairly, I had a, I tested pretty high when I was a kid, right? I had a fairly high IQ. And I don't have it anymore, so. But I was in these special programs, and I got good grades. And when I paid attention, I never cracked a book, man. I would just show up on Friday and pass the tests. That's the kind of kid that I was. I never took homework home. I don't think you ever saw a book at home. And this is my whole, well, at 16, you know, I'm under the influence all the time. I'm smoking a lot of weed. Your retention isn't there. And I dropped out of school. I actually got kicked out. I quit going, and then they put me in continuation, and I wouldn't go to that even. And then, so I dropped out of high school at 16. In the 11th grade. So at 17, I'm unemployable. I'm only 17 years old, but I don't have a job. And my mom is getting sick of the situation that it is at home. There'd never been any trouble with the law or anything like that. My friends had gotten and went to camps and YA and stuff like that, but I never had any serious trouble. There wasn't much serious crime. I was a criminal, but not that I got caught for. It was real petty stuff, you know, neighborhood crime. And so this is taking a lot longer than I thought it would to get sober. But I went to rehab when I was 18. I had a cocaine problem in the 80s. And my life was kind of a mix of Breakfast Club and Scarface, right? like that's the mixture of, and that's what I was shooting for, man, you know? And so it was like a John Hughes, Martin Scorsese film. That's my life, really, in a nutshell. And I went into rehab at 18, and when I was 19 or 20, I met Nikki. Nikki was my girlfriend in Young People's AA. So I was involved with Alcoholics Anonymous. I got introduced to the program. My mother had divorced the abusive guy and remarried another guy who wasn't abusive, but was an alcoholic and was in Alcoholics Anonymous. He relapsed after about 2 years of sobriety, I think, something like that. And this guy was a fifth-a-day whiskey drinker, so he was all business when it came to the drinking. But I knew about AA. I thought it was the place where you went to get a job, because every time he went to AA, he would go there and get a job. So I thought AA was a place where you go get a job. And so I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have any personal experience with it until I was 18. My mom, I'd been stealing from her, obviously. You know, we steal. That's the kind of alcoholic that I am. Like, I steal from the people closest to me. And so she put me in a rehab, and I got sober, and I stayed sober for a number of years. But I'm not really working a program, didn't really have a sponsor. I would attend the meetings. I was Young People's AA, man. I was like 18, 19, 20. I didn't care about what you people were talking about. I just wanted $1 million or something. I don't know. So I did, because I didn't want to work. I had all these character defects. I'm lazy. I'm self-centered to the extreme. Like, I don't have a program for living. I'm not qualified to do anything to make money. So what happened in my sobriety was I turned to crime. I started doing crime in sobriety. But I wasn't really involved in AA either. I was around, but I wasn't really involved. And what happens for me is eventually I get a toothache, and I got to go to the dentist, and I take a pill. And so when I was probably 23, I was maybe 6 years of sobriety, five and a half years, I took a pill. And then the pill took a pill, and then the pill took me. And so I took a pill and spent the next 5 years on the streets, an absolute maniac. The disease is progressive for me. If it is a disease, I don't know. I don't get to judge that stuff. All I know is that I like the effects produced by drugs and alcohol more than anybody that I've ever met. And the seeking, the getting, and the finding ways and means to get more and all that stuff, that's all it becomes for me. And I know that it's money. Money is the answer. So I start selling drugs, man, because the Scarface guy, that don't get high on your own supply, all those rules or whatever, I'm not using at the time. I'm taking a few pills here and there, but I'm not using, so I start selling drugs, and I sold a lot of drugs, and I made a ton of money, and then in 1995, I relapsed, and I was out for 5 years, and in 1995, I was indicted by the federal government for conspiracy to distribute methamphetamine, and they sentenced me to 23 years in federal prison. So the kid from Huntington Beach, Beverly Hills, whatever, right? Oregon for a little while, and yeah. High school dropout. I'm in prison. I'm going to prison, and I'm going for 20 years. And I was 28 years old, and I don't know if anybody, it's impossible unless you've done any time to like conceptualize like what that looks like for you as a human being. you're like, nah, you're gonna wake up and this is all a really bad dream, man. Like a really bad dream. But I spent the first 5 years I was locked up, and I did spend those 20 years in federal prison. They let me out last year. And I spent the first 5 years getting as loaded as I possibly could, trying to shut out the pain and humiliation and suffering that I was feeling at where my life had been, you know. I never saw it coming. You know what I mean? Like, I never saw that coming. Like, in Scarface, they died at the end, or so he got shot up or something. You don't have to go to prison for 20 years. Like, it's kind of like, wah, wah, wah. And, yeah, so I go into a new environment, and you know, it's a different environment. And they didn't send me to, like, the easy place or anything like that. I got caught with some escape paraphernalia in the very beginning, and I got caught with a handcuff key by the federal marshals, and so they put me in the bad place. So I was in the, you know, solitary confinement for the first 2 years of my incarceration. And then when I was transferred from place to place, I was like Hannibal Lecter. They put me in a separate cage. There's like all these guys on a prison bus, right? Well, I'm the guy in the cage with the shackles and the box and all that stuff. Like, I had become the kid from Huntington Beach who went, you know, I'm a body surfer, to the fucking Hannibal Lecter guy, man. And I never saw this come. I never saw that. I never related it to my alcoholism. I didn't have any idea that the two were connected. I didn't realize that my relapse would turn into this, right? I relapsed. Nikki's still sober, 29 and a half years, man. She's never spent a day in jail. Well, she did do a little time when she was 15. But but my point is, like, I didn't realize that taking that one Vicodin after that dentist visit was going to end up with me being the Hannibal Lecter guy in the bus on the way to maximum security penitentiary in Lompoc, California, when it was rock and roll. This wasn't no, you know, it was like this was the joint. And they moved me to a unit called Murder Unit. I was an M unit. And people were getting, you know, bad stuff was happening to people where I was at. And I was just trying to stay out of the way. But I also have a disease, right? And I want to be loaded now. Like, some people, like, oh, when things get bad or whatever, that's when it's like, I got nothing to lose. It's time to party now. Like, let's just get as loaded as we possibly can because my life is already destroyed. Like, it's not, cleaning up is not anywhere near the solution, you know? It's like staying as loaded as you can to blot out your existence is like what, and I thought I was going to try to stay as loaded as I could for the 20 years, get out, and I had a love affair with methamphetamine right before I came in, and drink vodka every day. I drink vodka. I'm the up-down guy, you know? Like, I like to go way up and then, like, you know, level out a little bit and then go way back up and then fall asleep for 3 days, you know? But I'll play darts in your house for 17 hours in the garage. And I'll try to fix your vacuum cleaner or, you know, anything that's broken. I'll try it. Carpet. I can do some carpet, I think, you know? So I spent the first 5 years chasing the bag inside. I was getting as loaded as I possibly could. I was trying to get girls to bring me drugs, you know. Yeah, I'm trying to get girls to bring me. I'm already in jail for drugs. And my partner tells me like this. My partner, Mikey, he's not one of us. And he says, really? You're getting drugs brought to, like, that's why you're there, man. But I couldn't even see that. I never even related the two. I just wanted to be loaded. And so I find myself in 2000, and I'm strung out. I'm in the joint, and I'm using heroin by this time because it's the prevalent drug. It's the easiest thing you can get. And I'd never even seen heroin before I went to prison, but, you know, I'm using heroin now. And smoking as much pot, I'm cooking wine, I'm doing all the things that we do in the penitentiary to stay as loaded as we can stay, and I burn all my bridges. You know, I'd been, ask mom, she'll tell you all the stories about me writing the next letter for I need money, they're going to kill me, you know, that kind of stuff. And so I was in a dangerous place with dangerous people, and you would give me some drugs and tell me I could pay you later, I'm taking the drugs. Like, it doesn't matter. If you're willing to give me the drugs and put them in my hand and I can put them in my body and I could pay you later, I'm taking whatever you're willing to give me. And what happens is you owe these people money, and then you have people all over, and they're not going anywhere, and they're killers. And you got to pay them or they're going to do something really bad to you, and I wasn't paying them. So I was kind of at the point where I was next on the list. Somebody was going to come get me. And so I thought, okay, I mean, I got a knife, you got a knife, and we'll just see what happens, right? It goes all the way to that extreme, like from body surfing to you got a knife, I got a knife, hand-to-hand combat in a cell. Who lives like that, man? But that's where I was at. You know, that was my reality. And I was playing softball because I like to play sports. I still like to be the attention guy. I play left center. I'm a good left center fielder, too. But that was a joke. But I know my pitch isn't funny today. I'm a little off. But I'm playing softball in the penitentiary, and I'm strung out. And what's going to happen is after the game, these guys are going to, because I'm drama. When I say I'm drama, like I'm the guy in prison. I don't know if you guys have watched prison shows. Some of you guys have been on the yard, but I'm the guy that when they see me coming, everybody's like, oh, fuck, here comes that guy, right? Because I'm strung out, man. And I'm trying to get something from you and to make me feel okay with what's going on with my life. And he was going to invite me. He was going to tell me that I couldn't play for their team anymore. See, I didn't realize, but I was playing on a sober softball team in prison. And I didn't even know they had AA in there, man. I was like, what? And so I'm playing on a sober softball team. Like six of the nine guys are sober. And there's me, the junkie, right? And they're going to kick me off the team. They're going to have their little team meeting and everything. Like they're going to tell me, look, we don't want, when the people come to get you, we don't want to be involved. So, you can't play anymore. That's what they're going to tell me. And instead, a man named David Boyd, he invited me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was June 20th of 2000. And June 21st, I went to a meeting, and I've been sober from that day to this. I haven't taken anything that affects me from the neck up, man. Nothing. I don't use drugs. I don't drink. And what happened for me was the change almost happened immediately. My mother could see it. My family members could see it. Like, I straightened up and flew right. But what really happened, what they didn't see what was going on, was the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. I dove in. You needed somebody to make the coffee. I went to all the meetings. I got a sponsor. I wrote a fourth step. I was fearless and thorough with my inventory. I shared everything, every dirty, rotten secret, every sex thing, all the stuff that I was never going to tell anybody, I shared that with another man. And I just had faith that the program was going to work. And it was because people like Revo and Tanya and other people in this room that were coming in there, and I could see that it was working in your life. And I knew that some of you had been where I had been. There were some guys that had done some serious time that were coming and carrying the message. And I don't know what happened. I don't know why or whatever. I just trusted that if I did the work in Alcoholics Anonymous, for the first time I had faith in something. Like, I'm a results guy. Like, I want to know what the payoff is before I do the work. If I'm going to go do some work, I want to know what the result or the payoff's going to be before I do it. Because I'm lazy. Like, I want to, and I'll try to find, is there another way I can do it easier so that I can get the same payoff? Yeah, it's the way that my mind works. And I just started doing the work in Alcoholics Anonymous. I set up the chairs. I showed up. I did what you hear people that have long-term sobriety were telling me to do. I started doing that stuff. I'll tell a couple of stories and about some beautiful people in Alcoholics Anonymous. But Curtis Larkin is a guy. He's an old H&I guy. He's an older black man. He died a few years back, but some people are shaking their heads right now. They know Curtis. And Curtis used to come into the penitentiary every week, and he would see us. And this is 2001, 2000. And he would tell me, he'd say, Shane, he was great. This guy was a character, man. And when I say a character, I mean he was straight out of a movie character. He'd say, Shane, I can drink anything I want today. I don't want that shit no more. I was just blown away. Like, how do you not want to drink or use drugs? I was new, man. And I still, my body was craving it. My mind was craving it. I mean, I was strung out when I came in, you know? And, he said, I don't want that stuff anymore. And I was just like, I was flabbergasted. Like, how do you do that? And he told me, he'd been sober like 25 years at that time. And he's like, you just do the things that we do, man. Another guy, Roman Chacon. I'll tell the Roman Chacon story and then I'll shut up. Roman was a couple years older than me. He was doing like 2 years for a bank robbery. He'd stolen $40,000 from a bank. Got drunk, he robbed the bank drunk, fell asleep in the getaway car, but he had time to go stash the money first, and then fell asleep in the car like a half a mile from the bank. They came, knocked on the window, and took him to jail, right? He gave the money back, so they gave him like a two-year sentence, which is crazy in the feds. Everybody's doing life sentence, 20 years, 25 years, and if you're where I'm at, you're doing hard time, you're doing long time. Nobody there was doing 2 years or a violation. Like, maybe 10 people a year got out of prison, you know? And, it was rare that you knew somebody that got out. And And Roman was doing 2 years, and he used to say, Shane, you're a really bad alcoholic. Roman had gone through Impact back in the day, in the 80s. He knew the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He knew the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You could open the book anywhere in the first 164 pages. This guy was amazing, photographic memory or whatever, and you could open it anywhere. And he said, Shane, open that book anywhere in the first 164 pages. So I opened it, and it's like Vision for You or something. It wasn't Vision for You. It was like Keys to the Kingdom. It was an obscure part, not something that we do in the readings. And I start reading, and he's sitting across from me in the cell, and I stop reading, and he keeps quoting the text in the book. This guy knew and verbatim. He anywhere in the first 164. He's fucking amazing, right? Couldn't stay sober. He knew the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He knew it mentally. He knew all the words. He knew everything that was, you know, that it takes, right? But he couldn't, it never went from the head to the heart. Or maybe it did for a period of time or whatever, because he had periods of sobriety. But he's married to a penthouse pet or whatever, right? And got two 12-year-old boys, twins, gorgeous kids, beautiful. Roman was a good-looking guy, beautiful old lady. They got good kids, right? And he used to come to the meetings at Lompoc when I first got sober, and I transferred to Phoenix. He couldn't get this thing, man. And he hung himself in a cell in the penitentiary with 2 years left, man. He had 2 years left, and he killed himself in the penitentiary because he couldn't get this thing. And this is a guy that knew the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so he used to tell me, he would say, Shane, recovery's not in that book. It's not in those meetings. Recovery's in your feet. It's what you do in Alcoholics Anonymous that keeps you sober. It's not what you talk about. I mean, it's all of those things, but it's in your feet, man. Exactly what Bob said, smart feet or whatever. And so what I did for the next 14 years that I was sober, that I was in the joint, was they worked with me. I started working with other guys, you know. They transferred me to another prison because my points got lower, and I went from maximum security to medium security to actually a low, which I never thought that I would hit. And I finished my time. The last 7 years I spent at Terminal Island in San Pedro, and that's where I met Revo. Revo came into the meeting. I met Tanya in the meeting. And then when I got out, I came to the Paramount group, and I reunited, reconnected with some friends. But what I did in there was I did the work of Alcoholics Anonymous. I worked with the new guys when they came in. I would meet with my sponsees, and we would do a book study. I've listened to hundreds of speaker tapes. My life in there became, like, I grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous in there, and I fell in love with this program. When I say that AA saved my very life, like some people say that, I mean AA saved my life. I was never going to make it out of there. Couldn't survive 15 more years of what I was doing. I had no chance. And I was going to kill somebody, or I was going to get killed or something like that. And that was the absolute truth. But God plucked me, man. And gave me a beautiful life, like something... Friends, like that guy David that took me to the meeting, he's my best friend. He got out in 05, and like I try to tell this, man, like I didn't pet a dog or hold a cat or raise a child. You know, I for 20 years, man, like I don't know if you know what that's like, the things that have value out here, like the little things and that kind of stuff, like. So for me to get out and not be this drug-addicted maniac criminal, because I was a criminal. I mean a criminal. And to have the life, the beautiful life that Alcoholics Anonymous gives me is like, it's such an honor and a privilege. I go to work every day, man. Curtis also told me stuff. He used to tell me stuff like... I read New Pair of Glasses when I was fairly new, right? And in that book, he says, hey, you know, you go to work, they give you some money, right? You go to work, they give you some money. You don't have to steal for your existence. You don't have to, you know, you can earn a living, get good at something and make some money, man. You don't have to be rich out here. It's nice, but you don't have to be. And so I go to work every day. I learned inside there how to go to work every day. I've been going to work every day for 15 years. Since I got sober, I go to work every day. Whether I want to go to work, I don't call in sick. If I'm not really sick, I don't call in sick. I go to work. And they give me some money, and I live. It's amazing, man. Like stuff that I didn't have any concept of when I got sober. And so I'm living a really beautiful life. I've been out for a year and a half now, and I have a host of friends. I've got thousands of people who know my name in Alcoholics Anonymous. I travel. I go to meetings a lot. You know, I can only travel in five counties, but I travel those five counties. And I work them all, right? And like I go to Bakersfield, you know, I get five counties, and so far, right? And I know people everywhere I go, man. Look, I know there's 15 people in this room that I know right now. We're in Palm Springs. I'm from Long Beach, man. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing to be a part of. I'm a very social creature. I like to know what's going on with you, man. And I won't maybe listen to, you know, an hour of what you're, you know, you could give me little snippets of what's happening in your life. Like I know Bob just moved or whatever. I knew that before the meeting started. But I like being involved in other people's lives. I like the camaraderie. I love the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the service. I love H&I. Saved my very life. And I owe everything that I am as a human being to hospitals and institutions, Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's why I'm involved. That's why I have a panel. I got a panel right when I first got out, asked Tanya. First H&I meeting, I got a panel. Boom. And I go to this insane asylum, too. It's perfect for me, right? They won't let me in the prisons yet, but it's coming, right? And so I got this panel at the mental institution, and it's kind of cool, man. I go with these crazy people. They're all 5150, and they're doing snack time and this and that. It's a ton of fun, man. I bring girls in there. It's great, man. So anyways, I'm right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm going to stay in the middle. And I know that the life that God has planned for me is a beautiful, like that talk last night she gave, wow. If you were here last night for that talk, wow, man. She killed it for me, man. I was in tears the whole time. But I want to thank you guys for coming. I want to thank everyone for coming to listen to me for a little while, because this is what I kind of need to do. This is my healing. My healing is sharing a message of recovery that no matter where you are, where you came from, what's happened in your life, that you can get this thing, man. Every person in this room has a story. It might not be the same story as mine, but we've all got our, you know, highs and lows in life and stuff like that. But if you're new especially, like dive into Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a completely transformed human being. My mom's right there. She knows. And thank you for letting me share.
Thank you. Okay. Well, hey, thanks everybody for coming to join us. And I'd like to, you know, special shout out to Revo from all of us.
Yay.
Up here, man.
Revo.
Can't even begin to tell you, brother. Thank you. All right. A vision for you. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right. And great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.